From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The man we're going to meet today is a self-described air pirate, possibly a mad scientist. He was the first broadcast engineer on staff at WHQR. He's written a book of fiction called The Ship's Cat, and he acted in the notoriously horrific film, The Deathbed, The Bed That Eats. He also helped design that bed that eats. Show of hands, how many people know yet who we're talking about? I keep forgetting this is radio. Here's the short version. Jock Brandes is an inventor, designer, actor, humanitarian, the founder of the Full Belly Project, a nonprofit in Wilmington that we'll hear more about today. Jock Brandes, it's about damn time. Welcome to Coastline.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. And we're inviting you to join this conversation. If you have a question for Jock Brandes, you can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Before we get into the very serious business of aflatoxin and what you're doing at Full Belly Project right now, tell us, what is an air pirate?
The Nigerian government said I was an air pirate. I was involved with Oxfam. I worked for Oxfam in the 70s during the Nigerian Civil War. And we flew big old aircraft into the middle of the rebel enclave and brought food in. It was basically a war of starvation. So we would fly in at night, obviously without permission from the Nigerian government, land on a three-lane highway, unload 17 tons of food, and take off again. And the Nigerian government got hold of all of our names, and in absentia, I think I was sentenced to life in hard labor in Nigeria, which is why I don't go through Nigeria anymore. When I travel around Africa, I tend to take other routes.
And you do fairly regularly travel around Africa.
I do a lot, yes.
And so you're safe in other parts of the continent. It's just Nigeria. You, at this point, is it still possible that you could be arrested there?
I think I would hide in the washroom. I would barricade myself in the washroom while we're on the ground in Lagos, and then I'd be safe, right? What could possibly go wrong?
So you are working on, well, you have developed a new device under the auspices of the Full Belly Project. You're a nonprofit. You're the founder of that. You're now the director of research and development. And it was aflatoxin that drove you to develop this. Tell us, what is aflatoxin?
Well, it started at the very beginning. I'm kind of famous as the guy who came up with this concrete peanut shelling device, which is in, 35 countries around the world, a very popular, simple device. And Jay Turbo, the co-founder of the Full Belly Project, and I were so proud. We went down to the University of Georgia to show this to all of the peanut, mavens in the university, and they were all very impressed. And Dr. Tim Williams, who was then, he's kind of the man who knew more about non-industrial growing of peanuts anywhere in the world. We all went off for dinner afterwards, and we were feeling good about it all. And he said, "Oh, really, when you're thinking it over, this device of yours is a great idea, but it's actually making more available a potentially very toxic food." And he explained to us, we didn't know for the first time, that all over the world, this fungus grows in the soil. And because peanuts live, they're ground nuts, they grow underground. They get contaminated by this fungus, and this produces an incredibly poisonous, toxic material, aflatoxin, and that the Center of Disease Control says that worldwide, more than 4 billion people suffer from some level of aflatoxin. They're basically poor people in warmer climates. And so Jay and I drove all the way back, feeling not quite so happy because we had now invented something that made this possibly toxic material more available. And we decided that we just had to focus on that and figure out a way to move on that. And
what does aflatoxin do to people?
I think it's why Africa is in a sorry state, and Haiti and a lot of places in the tropics. imagine now 4 billion people have some level of this contamination. The most dangerous thing is that in young people, often who get fed these high-protein foods, they suffer from mental and physical retardation. So essentially, you have an entire generation of people living in poor countries whose mental abilities are already impeded. You know, the great hopes we have for them are already set back because they come into, you know, they come into maturity. We are not allowed to say mentally retarded, but that's one of the effects. It also it impedes with your immune system. So people don't die of aflatoxin. They die of pneumonia, malaria, tuberculosis. The reason no one knows about it is that no one dies of aflatoxin. They die of something else. And because it's in food and women can absorb it through their skin, women tend to die of liver and pancreatic cancer. It's the number one cause of liver and pancreatic cancer in Africa. And it's everywhere. The problem with it has been that it's like when the HIV epidemic first came out, the response by a lot of agencies and governments was denial. You know, pretend it doesn't happen or try and restrict the statistics so people don't panic. And I was just meeting with the head of the aflatoxin project for the African Union, and Dr. Amara, who's from Ethiopia, and he was saying, well, you know, in most of Africa, aflatoxin statistics are state secrets. You can bring in a sample to be tested, but unless the number comes in at the official figure, they will not release it. So everyone lives in this kind of state of panic because no one has simple tools in order to do the test. So we were incredibly lucky. I stumbled across an amazing guy in Colorado, Dr. Don Cooper, who received funding from the Gates Foundation. It was supposed to be a three-stage program for a simple, what I would call a tailgate test. So you could test instantly for aflatoxin anywhere. Right now, it's an expensive test in an air-conditioned laboratory with refrigerated reagents and a very skilled
lab. And what are you testing, the peanuts that have been harvested, or can this test it?
Testing peanuts and corn and cassava and all these things. So Dr. Don got money from the Gates Foundation to do phase one and two. He came up with this device, and then they didn't give him phase three. So he had gotten himself right to the edge. He had a device he had never tried in the field. He had never done anything with it that wasn't in the lab. And he just basically handed it all over to us to see what we could do with it. And that was an amazing piece of luck because we don't do that kind of high-tech stuff. We could never have gotten that Gates funding ourselves. And we took it to Africa. A fellow named Randy Shackelford and I went to Africa. We did the first real tailgate test.
How long ago was that?
That was about a year and a half ago. And we went into villages in Africa and Uganda and Kenya and realized that there was not really that big a cause for panic, that once you have this simple testing device, you can quickly and easily see a pattern. You can identify the problem. You can deal with aflatoxin because you understand, working like detectives now, very quickly a picture comes in as to where the toxicity comes in, and we're all told that it happens in the soil, and we discover it doesn't happen in the soil. It happens in bad storage.
Already harvested crops.
Yeah. That's what we found the big problem was. So all of a sudden, I was just at a big Catholic.
So it's not in the soil.
It comes from the soil, and it comes out of the soil at very, very low levels. It comes out at 3-4 parts per billion, and then you store it badly. And that's when it starts to happen. So if you can change your post-harvest and you can change your marketing, you can deal with this in a much more efficient way. You know, aflatoxin is a big problem in the United States. It is the number one budget item for the U.S. Department of Agriculture every year. Every year, this country spends $660 million on aflatoxin testing and regulation It's a huge thing, but again, no one knows about it because no one dies of it. But it's a huge problem everywhere in the world. So
what happens for the crops that are deemed to be, they have too much aflatoxin to be consumable? Can you wash it off, or are those crops dumped?
In the United States, you can blend with grains when they find that grains have too much aflatoxin. They blend it with a clay called bentonite, which is normally used as an oil rig lubricant. And for some reason, the bentonite absorbs the aflatoxin onto its surface and neutralizes it. But humans don't necessarily want to be eating food that's mixed with clay. So it can be reused. You know, peanuts that are contaminated can be pressed for oil. But I was just in a field in McRae, Georgia, and the levels there actually coming out of the field, that was an unusual situation, were so bad that they probably should have just plowed it under entirely. But it's a huge problem in the United States.
This is a relatively simple device that you can bring to farmers. And who uses it? Is it the farmers? Is it people who buy the crops? Who uses it?
What we want to do, I took the first of these kits into a farm cooperative in Uganda. And I sat down with two farm co-op workers, and I said, I'm going to show you how to do this, and then you're going to see how easy it is to learn. And in 45 minutes, they were doing a test that until now would have been a very expensive test by a skilled technician in a lab.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with Jock Brandes, Director of Research and Development of the Full Belly Project, a local nonprofit dedicated to designing and distributing income-generating devices that improve life in rural communities. And he's taking your questions on this Wednesday. The phone lines are now open. Give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with Jock Brandes, who has worked in the film industry in just about every conceivable capacity. He's written a novel based on his experiences in the Nigerian Civil War, and he is an air pirate, also from his experiences in the Nigerian Civil War. Jock Brandes is with us today, and he's taking your questions. Or if you have a story about Jock that he's unlikely to tell us on the air, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org.
You really don't want to start with a story, do you?
Well, Jock, there are so many things around the Full Belly Project. You were just explaining the newest device that tests for aflatoxin and is being used now in Uganda. Are there other parts of Africa where this tester is being used?
We've gone in and done the testing, and what we're going to be doing in the next few weeks is actually making the first complete kit with instructions. It has a little iPad in it, which actually does the final test, and it will also hold a tutorial. And so we're at the point of making custom-made foam-lined cases with little pockets and instructions and whatnot. The idea is it'll probably start with Catholic Relief Services, where these things get distributed around, and either farmers groups or buyers or academics can borrow one of these kits for a couple weeks, go into an area, do an aflatoxin profile, or buyers can use them, or whatever the idea is, they will be made available on a lending or rental basis. And I think they're also going to be in big demand here in the United States. I think county extension agents are going to get a lot of requests from farmers to say, can you come out to my field and test my field? Can you come out to my granary and test my product? And it can be done right on the spot. And it's $5 a test as compared with the other tests we were doing here, $150 per, and it takes you about 10 days to get the results back. So it's kind of a breakthrough. I mean, the whole idea we're trying to do two things. We're dealing about health, especially children's health, to get rid of this really nasty toxin. But our mission is to try and create economic opportunities for small farmers, mostly women small farmers who do most of the work in, I think, most of the world. And right now, these farmers are growing basically a fairly toxic crop, which then they take to their local market and sit next to the other women who are selling the same product, and there's no profit in that. We think we can get the peanuts from small farmers in Africa onto the snack food shelves in the European Union. That's the most expensive peanut in the world is in a little snack pack in Denmark. And if we can get the safety level such so that Europe will allow these imports, you can't get a lot of African food products into Europe because the aflatoxin problem is so bad. So if you now have a tool where you can measure the problem, imagine an electrician who doesn't have an electrical meter. You know, I mean, if you're a food exporter and you don't have an aflatoxin meter, you're not going to get anywhere. So we're basically trying to create a new economy for African food exports to get more money in the pockets of these small women. It's a value-added thing. If you can get that a fair trade stream back from Europe to the woman who does the farming, this is going to be a great opportunity for her. So we're thinking of health, but we're particularly thinking of economics.
Why just the EU? Is it something that could come into the United States?
Well, it can come into the United States, but, I mean, if you look at, you know, Europe is a short hike from the number one peanut grower in Africa. That's Senegal. I mean, that's a one day's cruise by a shipping container. And we're working with Catholic Relief Services in Baltimore to try and make this happen. And in order to get some bigger guns behind us and a few more creds, it looks like we're going up to Purdue University. So we can look a little more professional if we can list Purdue as one of our collaborators in this whole project. They're very interested in what we're doing, and they already have some of the tools you need to get you halfway there. But if it can be Catholic Relief Services, Purdue University, and Full Belly Project working together, I think we could move pretty quickly, because all of a sudden people will get a lot more confidence because we would have these essentially those big guys working with us.
What is Purdue University's role? Will they be testing it and saying, yes, it works to this level of accuracy, or what will they do?
They already have a system which is, they call it a PICS bag, which is a sealed bag, in a sealable bag where you can put produce in and then seal it off. And it essentially, if the food product is still alive, like peanuts or grain or whatnot, they very rapidly draw down the oxygen inside the bag, and it kind of stabilizes it to a point where bacteria and viruses and insect eggs won't progress any further. So they have that. It's a very well distributed system around the world. But we found that it doesn't serve well with aflatoxin, because the fungus has a really nasty habit that it, like a skunk, it panics when it's threatened. And that fungus, when the oxygen level drops down, panics and starts doing a protective thing and suddenly pumps out a lot of toxins. So you're, at the same time as you're reducing all the other things, you're increasing the possibility of aflatoxin. So the other thing we want to do with Purdue is we have this idea that you can pump ozone into these bags, and that will sterilize it. I mean, we eat ozonated food here in America all the time. You can't get seafood that hasn't been, you know, cleansed with ozone somewhere along the way. They fill freight cars in California with lettuce and pump ozone into it, and by the time it gets here, all the ozone is just turned back to oxygen. It is a beautiful thing, because you take air, you energize it in a way that some of the oxygen molecules become O3. That's a perfect cleansing agent that kills bacteria, viruses. It's a perfect cleansing agent. And it has a half-life of about 18 hours. So by the time you open the container, all that O3 is back to O2. No bags of chemicals, no chemical residue. And I'm picking up a milk pitcher here, but my ozone generator is about that size.
And so the people at Purdue helped to develop this?
No, we did.
You did, at the Full Belly Project.
Yeah, we did this, and we've been trying to get Purdue interested in it. They've been doing some lab work, but they tend to support large ozone operations in America. If you have a contaminated, if you have a grain elevator in Iowa and it's contaminated with aflatoxin, you'll phone up Ozone Solutions and a guy will come up with a truck and hook some tubes into your grain elevator, turn on the switch and come back 6 days later and it's all been sterilized and cured and it's all perfectly safe. So we're already using ozone to deal with aflatoxin in the United States on a commercial basis. So what we're trying to do is to simplify it and get it down to the village level in Africa. I mean, really all you need to make this machine is a bicycle pump and a solar panel. It doesn't get much simpler than that.
And it sounds like all of these inventions have come from just this one idea of we want to help these farmers be able to develop a sustainable food source and have a water source. There's a whole list of products developed under the aegis of Full Belly Project. But before we get to those, Toby writes in, full disclosure, I'm a volunteer that works on the project with Jock. When I talk to folks about these projects in Africa, a question often asked is, why are you guys only doing this in Africa? We've got problems here. This comment is reflected in the national discussion right now regarding America's role in the world. In a piece regarding foreign aid last weekend's New York Times, those that work on these projects know there's a direct line between the development of first world and third world technologies. Can you talk to that, Jock?
Well, you should come out with me in maybe 3 or 4 weeks out to Lumbee Indian Territory. And I'll be driving up Highway 74 and we'll be doing some large-scale demonstrations of solar irrigation systems for cattle or solar watering systems for cattle. We'll be teaching people to build this technology themselves. But we do stuff closer to home than that. And what we do in North Carolina is essentially solar irrigation or cattle water or illegally teaching people how to dig their own agricultural wells. You're not allowed to do that, and I'm not allowed to talk about that on the air.
So
but
you're
I can't stand
a hydro
around.
Pirate as well.
I can stand around the farm, and as long as you don't pay me, I can tell you what to do on your own farm. As soon as you pay me, we're all in jail.
Okay. And Darcel from Leland asks, can he specify how much money he's raised? What are the long-term financial goals for the Full Belly Project?
Well, we have our annual budget is about $180,000 to $190,000. We have a staff of 2.5. We have an incredible array of, Toby is one of them, of volunteers, about 25 or 30 very reliable, very highly motivated volunteers. And I always say we because I'm just the guy who herds cats. These are the genius people who come up with it. And, you know, I make sure that you should see an inventing session on a Saturday morning. They're inventing and they're sending me to the hardware store to get them stuff because, you know, they've got this whole thing figured out. They just need me to go because I have the credit card.
Well, you know, that stretches credulity to some degree, Jock. You are the winner of CNN's Hero Award. You're considered a CNN hero. You won the Popular Mechanics Award for, I don't have it in front of me right now, but innovation, breakthrough. And innovation, that you won the Purpose Award. Before we went on the air, you talked about what fires your rockets, and the way you put it was interesting because I was saying it's hard to talk to a guy who is a hero and a humanitarian and who is driven by such lofty ideals and deep motivations to save the world. And then you said, well,
I said it's way more fun than making movies. I mean, if you want to know the truth, I was doing a terrible movie here in town called Domestic Disturbance with John Travolta and Vince Vaughn, and I said to myself, if the rest of my life is dealing with pain in the ass people like these two superstars, then I'm just going to go and gouge my eyes out and get on disability because I had had it at that point with the film business. It had it with me. We decided to part company, and I kind of stumbled into this. All my film friends were always making jokes about how when I was I would be lost in thought on the film set, and they'd say, oh, he's dreaming about drip irrigation in Zimbabwe. And the truth is that I was.
And why is that? Where does that come from? How did you get interested in helping African farmers?
Well, first of all, I was raised on a farm in northern British Columbia, and my father and mother both made it plain that, you know, that in all of our lives we should do service to others less fortunate. My father always, who was a farmer, thought I should get into agriculture, and I should get into simple appropriate agriculture because he was one of the early non-chemical small-scale organic farming guys, which at that point was completely, that was like crazy talk. And of course I wanted to go to Hollywood and hang around in hot tubs with movie stars, and that's what I wanted to do. So I did that, and then it led me to, you know, John Travolta and Vince Vaughn, and I said I got to make a big change. And by that point, I thought to myself, you know, I was ready for this kind of thing. We had already been, at that point, playing around with the idea of a peanut sheller, which came because of my big mouth. You've got to realize that the Full Belly Project is request-driven. We only do these things because people approach us, and then we try to come up with solutions. Some of what we do is we research the old data. We have, you know, my high school kids on Saturday morning go online and see how they solved the problem in Georgia in 1910. Or someone goes to the patent record and see, is there a device like this already? How can we make it simple? Is the patent still in existence? You know, we do more traditional bits of research before we get down to the basic inventing.
The universal peanut sheller, that was your first big kind of humanitarian invention. And that specific thing, how did that come about? Your big mouth.
My big mouth. I worked on one of the worst movies ever made. That's a long list. Dracula 2000. and the script assistant, it was 2:30 in the morning on the prison on Division Drive, and we were trying to make the mechanical bat fly through the window on a string, and it wasn't working. And the script assistant threw down her script and said, you know, I've had it. God didn't put me on this planet to do this. I'm going to join the Peace Corps. And she just stomped off the set. And about 6 months later, I get a call from her saying, I'm in this perfect little paradise village in Mali, and we have a solar water system that was put in by the Danish government and is not working, and people are starting to drink from livestock wells, and cholera is coming back. Back in the movie days, you could fix anything. Why don't you get on the plane and come over here? And I did that. And then when I was there, kind of on the way of town, I saw women shelling peanuts with their bare hands, and their fingers were literally raw from shelling peanuts because they do a sun-dried peanut. I mean, a roasted peanut comes apart in your hand pretty well, but just a dry peanut is like a little stone.
And they were doing bushels and bushels of these.
And the head woman said, when you're back in Africa, or when you're back in America, can you find a hand-operated peanut sheller and send it back to us? I said, of course. You know, this is me and my big mouth. So I came back, looked everywhere, couldn't find it, contacted, I'm a Canadian kid, who are you going to go to if you have a peanut problem? I contacted Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter's office put me in touch with the University of Georgia, and they said, you know, forget about it. That's like the holy grail of sustainable agriculture.
What, a peanut sheller?
Peanut shelling, yeah, because at that point, you know, peanuts are incredibly good for the soil because they, you know, they're legumes, they regenerate and overused soil. I invented the machine, and then I had to go back and introduce it there. And unfortunately, a film company followed me there and filmed the introduction. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Discovery Channel shows this damn thing all over the world, and I was in trouble. So a bunch of Peace Corps volunteers, returned Peace Corps volunteers here in Wilmington said, let's start the Full Belly Project, and all we're going to do is help people build these machines for themselves.
So you just skipped over the biggest part of that story, which you just said, so I invented the thing. And, yeah. You know, and Jimmy Carter had said, his organization had said, good luck with that. You went to the University of Georgia. Were they any help?
No, they were the ones who said, good luck with that.
Okay.
I think the phrase was, better men and more money have tried. I think that was the phrase that got me going.
Okay. So how did you go from some of the best minds who've been focused on this idea of wanted to do something like this, to actually saying, oh, well, here it is, guys. This is the design.
Well, if you work in the movie business, you know, you get these completely out of the blue requests and you have a short amount of time to do it and a budget. So you have to be really good at these things, you know. You know, we want to crash a flying saucer into the Brooklyn Bridge and we want to do it next Thursday. You know, you just do that kind of thing. And we want a large mechanical snake that eats live rats. Okay, you know, you do. That's what we did. So, you know, it wasn't that big a stretch. They did, Dr. Williams at the University of Georgia did give me kind of a hint in which direction to go because he had heard a rumor of some machine in Bulgaria that had a, and he described it and we duplicated that and it didn't work. But that gave me an idea on how to change it around, and that was my clue. So I got kind of a hint on that.
The rocket water pump, where does that fall chronologically in terms of these inventions that you've developed that are now distributed through Full Belly?
Well, that was because we were doing a peanut project, and it was one of those absolutely nothing can go wrong projects. This was the most perfectly designed project ever. Working with the University of Florida, we went into Guyana. They had markets, transportation, better qualities, everything, better crop seeds. Everything was going to be perfect, and the whole project failed because the rains didn't come. And so, you know, I realized at that point that hunger around the world doesn't have that much to do with food. It has more to do with water. That's my elevator phrase. When I want to get someone interested and I'm in an elevator in the UN and I want to get someone interested, I just come out with this line, you know, hunger has nothing to do with food. It has to do with water. And then they have to start the conversation.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Jock Brandis, mad scientist, air pirate, founder of the Full Belly Project, and creator of the Universal Peanut Sheller. When we come back from this 90-second break, we'll find out, we'll ask Guy from Wilmington's question about a cotton gin for small African farmers. You can ask your question of Jock Brandis on this Wednesday by calling 910-343-1138 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're meeting Jock Brandis, who's acted in films, written a novel, conducted food drops during the Nigerian Civil War, and served as WHQR's first on-staff broadcast engineer. You have a few minutes left to ask your own question of Jock Brandis on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or by emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Jock, just before we went to break, I promised we'd get to Guy from Wilmington's question. And he wants to know when you're going to invent a cotton gin that works for small African farmers.
Well, as Guy, can I use your last name, Guy? As Guy very well knows, this is a project we've been working on for a while. And we can do it at a very small scale. That's sometimes the problem. You come up with a device that works on a tabletop, and then when you start looking at the whole continent, you have to kind of look beyond that. Well, Guy's been actually has educated me on the whole business of cotton. And the answer to you, Guy, is, of course, soon. But that comes under the same philosophy as we had with peanuts, which is that if you can get African farm commodities onto the global market, then you can start getting, you know, global profits heading back upstream. And hopefully, if some kind of fair trade organization is involved, you can get those profits back to the farmer. And cotton is a great opportunity because it is not regulated by the very stringent food safety issues. I mean, cotton not being a food, but being a global commodity is one of the best ways to go. Cotton actually is one of the reasons why you need to grow peanuts, because cotton is so disruptive on the soil that you really want to be growing peanuts either in between the cotton plants or as an alternate row, as an alternate crop. Anyone who knows the history of the American South knows that that the cotton industry essentially came to pieces over a period of time because it depleted the soil so much. And it was George Washington Carver, as every Canadian boy knows, who introduced peanuts as an alternate crop to regenerate the soil. So it's one of the reasons that cotton and peanuts kind of could work together so well.
Well, given your drive right now to get this test for aflatoxin distributed to the people who can use it in Africa, it seems like that would be your top priority. But knowing that your sense of possibility was shaped by the film industry, and that's how you started exercising your inventor muscle, what kind of time frame would you give Guy for developing this cotton gin? Because, you know, in film, you've got a deadline. You're going to shoot this scene tomorrow with the bat flying through the window. So,
but, of course, you've also got a budget. We have it on a kind of on a tabletop scale, and I think maybe Guy should take me out to lunch sometime, and we should follow this up. I have a bunch of prototypes I could show him. But, you know, we have these things that sit on a shelf and wait until – sometimes you have to let these things percolate. You have to let people think about it. You have to let people go back and go online for a while and look for videos and try to figure out ways to do it. One of the beauties of this is it doesn't have to be done by next Thursday, and that allows for a group think, because we are a group think organization, to move ahead. But I can't tell Guy when, but I must remind him that he did talk about how he was going to get some money for me from the Cotton Council, and I'm going to ask Guy when that's going to come in.
Okay, Guy, you're on the hook first, it sounds like, for lunch and money from the Cotton Council. There are a couple of stories that have emerged before the Full Belly Project days, and we need to get to Deathbed, the Bed That Eats. That had a recent resurgence here in Wilmington with Gwenifer Roller, who, of course, you worked with her on the stage adaptation. But this is known as one of the worst films of all time, isn't it?
Bob Mondello claimed that it was, in fact, the worst film ever made in America, worse than Plan 9 from Outer Space.
That's quite a distinction, Jack Brandis.
When I heard that, I was driving down the road, I got so excited because, I mean, I'll never work on Forrest Gump or Citizen Kane, but I can work on the Citizen Kane of furniture-eating movies.
You acted in this film and you developed, you designed the bed that eats. So who came to you saying, Jock, we need a bed that eats people?
It was a dark and stormy night. At midnight, I'm serious. At midnight, there's a knock on the door and there's three strange-looking people, one who looks for all the world like a vampire, one who was a complete double for Peter Lorre, and sort of a Jessica Rabbit person standing in the middle, said, we're doing this movie in Detroit and we've got to get a clandestine Canadian crew down there because Detroit is a union town and we have to always film after midnight and you want to come down and it's about a bed that eats people. So I thought, why not?
And how long did it take you to develop? What were some of the difficulties that you ran across? Why is this not a simple thing?
Because my budget, I think, for the bed was $350.
And this was what year?
Oh, this was 1974 or something like that. 70, I don't know. Somewhere there.
And
yeah.
So what did it have to do that was special? What did the special effects come from?
Well, it's great if you've got no experience and no money, but you're basically kind of a problem-solving kid. So I figured you make a bed which has four air mattresses in it, and you make a big kind of foam pipe of – like foam rubber, which you fill with detergent Mr. Bubble in yellow food coloring. And when you pump air into it, this horrible yellow saliva-like froth comes out. And you put that just under the cover of the bed where someone's lying at the same time as you let the air out of the air mattresses so the person sinks into the bed. This horrible slimy material comes out and they pretend to struggle, which of course they're not doing, and then they get eaten by the bed. And then you do the close-up of bubbles coming out of their skull and that kind of stuff. You know, it's the basic stuff.
Sure. How many people were eaten by the bed?
Oh, maybe five or six.
And you were one of them.
Well, I wasn't going to be eaten by it, but when the director said, I'm going to demonstrate this to you, he said, we're on a budget. We're not going to waste all that Mr. Bubble and food coloring. Get Jock in costume and write him into the script. And I became a priest who was lying in this bed in a level of ecstasy reading the Bible when I got eaten by the bed.
Let's just hold that image for a moment in our minds, shall we? Now, you wrote a book called The Ship's Cat. And
it's a great book.
And it's available on Amazon.
No, it's available across the street here at
Of course.
It's in the front window.
It's in the front window.
Yes,
of course it would
and
be.
And people still don't buy it and it's in the front window. I wonder why.
Okay, well, hopefully now we'll have a run on The Ship's Cat at Old Books on Front Street.
I'm hoping.
This is fiction, but it's based on actual experiences that you had as an air pirate.
Well, I went over to this Portuguese prison colony. It was like Devil's Island that the Portuguese government had off the shore of – off the coast of Africa.
This is real, right?
Yeah. It's the island of Sao
Tome.
No, the island of Sao Tome was where Oxfam flew out of. And we would – it was a 90-minute flight into, you know, the center of Nigeria. And there was this enclave of people who were basically starving to death. They had been surrounded and there were – and the Nigerian government was completely prepared to let them all die. And Oxfam decided to fly food into the middle of the night. And I originally went in there just to fix the airplanes. I didn't know anything about fixing airplanes, but they needed people to fill shrapnel holes in the fuel tanks. That should have been my first clue that maybe this was not a good job to have. But I'm warning anyone who wants to get into an African civil war, make sure you always get onto the winning side, because the losing side of an African civil war is not a pretty sight.
Sounds like a good strategy.
It's an interesting book, and I never did much else. It was kind of a catharsis thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got all this stuff in your head, the best thing to do is write it down, and then it's gone, like vomit, it's gone.
What role did Kurt Vonnegut play in getting you to write this book?
Well, it was a bet. In the middle, we were about to leave. We would only operate at night because as soon as the sun would rise, the Nigerian bombers would come over and bomb the airfield. So he had to be, I call it an airfield, it was a piece of highway. So the sun was about to rise and we were packing up, and out of the bushes came clearly Kurt Vonnegut, who wanted to get a ride out of there. He thought we were the gun runner to Cameroon, and he came back with us instead. And on the runway back in the Portuguese prison colony, we started talking, waiting to get picked up. And I said, well, someone should write a book about this, and it's probably going to be you. He said, well, whichever one of us writes the book first wins. And I won, I thought. He wrote a short story in Juan Peters Foma about it, which was I thought, an average short story. But I personally think that mine is better than Kurt's, and it's a full-length novel. And frankly, he never acknowledged the fact that I won.
Did you write to him?
His agent.
And what did you get back?
I got the agent connected me with someone in France who wanted to translate it into French. That's all I got back.
So no acknowledgement that you won. Wow. Well, that's kind of crummy.
He was busy that day, I'm sure. He can't be, you know, he's got a fan base.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today with Jacques Brandes, the founder of the Full Belly Project, the writer, the author of The Ship's Cat, about his time in the Nigerian Civil War. It's fiction, though. He's the inventor of the Universal Peanut Sheller, for one, and he's won numerous awards. I could go on, but we only have a few minutes left. You can still get your question in for Jacques on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138, or you can email us at coastline@whqr.org, and it looks like Susie Hamilton has done exactly that. And she has one question for you, Doc. Are you ready?
For Susie, anytime.
Wow, there was even gravel, extra gravel to his voice there, Susie. Did you get that? Susie asks, will you marry me? Here, Doc, let me help you get off the floor. He's on the floor. No, we can... Grab my hand.
Let me say, Susie, I'm going to save the first dance for you at the Full Belly Feast on the 25th of February. It's our fundraiser. You can come in and you can see all of our new aflatoxin testing technology, and you can meet me in person. And did I get out of that one well enough?
I think that was genius. Thank you so much, Susie.
First dance, Susie.
And of course, we will post the information about that fundraiser that's coming up on the Coastline Post on WHQR.org. Tim writes, Jock Brandis's work is very interesting to me as a professional agronomist for North Carolina, one approaching retirement soon, looking for some way to occupy myself in my senior years. Oh, I smell a volunteer coming who could be part of the Mad Scientist Inventor team. Had the privilege of doing F2F teaching assignments, soil fertility, and maize production in the Rift Valley of Ethiopia. While there, I observed one of the great needs was simple herd and range management. The farmers of Ethiopia have a great cultural and social attachment to their cattle, but the unmanaged overgrazing is thwarting the optimal use of a natural resource, as well as depleting soil resources and creating dust storms. Your solar watering system is interesting, but perhaps you might look at solar-energized fencing to address the forage availability issues in the savannas.
We always hope that people who know what they're talking about walk in our doors, because, you know, it sounds like this is a gentleman who should drop in. We're at the corner of 11th and Chestnut. We used to say there's a big red double-decker bus in the backyard, but it's gone. But why don't you drop in at the Full Belly Project and we can talk about this. We would love, if you got some time on your hands and you actually know what you're talking about as compared with the rest of us, that would be great.
During the 70s, you and your wife, Susanna, were the subjects of a documentary film called The Salvage Prince, because you haven't done enough disparate things, which actually what we're finding is there's a thread through all of them that has led you to this moment. That's,
wait a minute. You're actually on HQR going to lead them to a film which shows me naked in a bathtub in my earlier years. You actually did this to me, Rachel.
I didn't know that you were naked in a bathtub.
This is a National Film Board of Canada film. Imagine that the government of Canada starts making your home movies for you.
Where is the film available?
Oh, Lord. It's on YouTube, of course. Everything's on YouTube.
Paul writes, Jock, do you need help?
Yes, I do. Right now.
In your shop, that is.
Sure. Ask him to come by. Yeah, I'm sweating a little bit here. I'm getting some really heavy questions here. I was expecting these to be like softball questions.
Never expected you'd get a marriage proposal on the program today.
And from Susie.
From one of our state representatives. Yes.
Yes.
If you could travel back in time and talk to your 16-year-old self or your 12-year-old self, what would you tell him?
Wow, you could have warned me about this a little earlier. I think you just have to say follow the fun. Because in the end, you know, follow your heart sounds. You keep using this humanitarian word.
Yeah.
Which you hang around my shoulder like a large dead albatross.
You walked in the door with it.
I'm not a humanitarian. I'm a man who's followed his fun. You know, I'm doing what I do because it's more fun than hanging around with John Travolta. You know, he doesn't realize how much he's helped small farmers in Africa by being such a pain in the ass. I think you just have to follow your fun. And, yeah, at a certain point in the middle of your life, you do the family and the responsibility and you do all that. But then when that kind of thins itself out, I mean, I'm 70 years old and I'm still following my fun. And, you know, when I was raising kids, I couldn't indulge in this kind of stuff. So you can take a little gap in the middle and be a responsible parent and adult and then get back to following your fun.
How do you determine the difference between following your fun and being irresponsible? In other words, you have an organization. You have a nonprofit that you're running.
Yeah, but for me, that's the most fun in the world.
And that's this edition of Coastline. We could take another hour with that one idea, but we won't. Jock Brandis, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director, Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3, and we will post that information about the Full Belly Project's upcoming fundraiser. Join us for Coastline Thursday when we look at the Echo Farms controversy and the precedent it could set for land development. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.